A lot of things which are usually in government hands are private now. Corporations shape our daily life probably as much as our governments these days. It's very important that shareholder voices are heard. While we use this term corporate democracy for corporations, it's not a democracy.
Welcome to No Mustard, the knowledge podcast by the St. Gallen Collegium, St. Gallen, Switzerland. My name is Wolfram Eilenberger, your host for this season. Friends of freedom, welcome or welcome back to Ohne Senf, No Mustard, the knowledge podcast by the St. Gallen Collegium at the University of St. Gallen. Let me start with a question. What do Walmart, Alphabet, the UBS, the Daimler Group and Swiss Re have possibly in common? Well, the answer is easy. Each of them has more financial and possibly political power than most nation states on planet Earth. But who governs these corporations and how do they govern us? That is the question of corporate governance. And that question is at the center of the research of my guest today. Her name is Tania Artiga González. She is Associate Professor of Finance at the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam. She is the Senf Fellow of this year's St. Gallen Collegium and happy to be here with you. Welcome, Tania. So, Tania, corporate governance, that is a strange concept and a strange name to many people. What is it about?
I think it's about how we manage our firms. So what we have to understand is that the shareholders are the owners of a corporation, but they do not manage the corporation. They are dispersed, they don't have the time, they don't have the knowledge. So what they do is they delegate someone, the managers, the CEO, the management team, to manage the company.
And they run the show.
They run the show. They are in charge. But while the management is also often a shareholder, right, they might have different interests. And that is what we usually call conflicts of interest in between the owners of a corporation and who managed the corporation. And in order to align interest and to help with the processes that the management team works in line with what shareholders want, we have corporate governance. So that is a system of rules and regulations which govern a firm.
That is interesting because the definition of what it means to govern could be to align interests. And in states or nation states, we have a procedure which we call democracy to align these interests. And in preparing our talk, I was reading a paper of yours and I was stumbling over a concept that I didn't know and it sounded terribly interesting to me. That concept was corporate democracy. My question, what is it? And why should it exist, especially from the point of view of the corporations themselves?
Well, these are two or three different points which we have to disentangle. So I think the common perception is that the term corporate democracy was introduced more as a marketing feature than as a real theory. So in the 60s, 70s, people wanted more retail shareholders, so individual, to invest in a company. So there was a promise that a company is as a shareholder, that there's an underlying democratic process. So this is why this term exists, or why we think that this term exists.
So the term is a selling device initially.
That's what the legend is saying, right? So of course, afterwards, there's a theory around it has evolved. But when we start with this agency conflicts, or this conflicts of interest in between the owners who only provide money and who would like to see a return on their investment. Some owners have also side objectives, but we have to be clear, we invest in order to gain a return on our investment, and managers who could have other objectives. And in order to do this, we need to see, okay, so what can shareholders do to have a say in the corporation? One thing is to elect the board of directors who is supervising the management team. And another thing is corporate voting. And corporate voting is part of this corporate democracy framework. So it is that shareholders once a year at the annual meeting can go and vote on issues within the firm. So one thing is they vote usually on the board of directors, so on each of the directors, they ratify the auditors. In certain countries, there's also say on pay, so they can vote on the compensation packages for the management team. And this is what we usually term this corporate voting, corporate democracy.
And that is the shareholder voice, so yes, to speak.
Because shareholder can, we always talk about voice and exit. So shareholders can leave the company. So if you're not happy, you can just sell. That is completely different from what we have when we have nation states, right? Oh, I don't like it. I sell my shares within the corporation.
But you said that's the shareholder voice.
Voice, yeah.
This is how we started.
You have exit and then you have voice where you can, through voting, say what you would like to do within the corporation.
But, you know, this analogy between states and corporations certainly has limits. A state is not a corporation. And what are, to your mind, the main differences when it comes to the voicing of dissent or agreement?
Let's start very simple. You can hold a basket of shares of different corporations, whereas we're usually citizens of one, maybe two. There are exceptions to three nation states, right? So voting is something different because it's a mass product. The more corporations you hold in your portfolio, the more you are expected to vote. Because we cannot do this, there are all kinds of processes in place who take these voting decisions from us. But I think that is one difference. The second difference is, of course, we can sell our shares to somebody else. I mean, we cannot sell our political votes.
And we cannot really sell our citizenship either.
Well, it depends, but yes. And the third one is, of course, that we have one share, one vote. So that means the more shares you hold, the more power you have within the corporation, where, of course, the basis of our democracies is that everyone has one vote and that vote is counted equally.
Is there not also a difference between the very objective of a state and a corporation? One could say the objective of a state is to secure the rule of law and maybe the security of its citizens, whereas, and I'm speaking as a total amateur here, the objective of a corporation or company is to make money and more money. So that's a very different purpose, isn't it?
Yes, of course. But I think, therefore, corporations are also not states, right? So I think they are players or objectives within our society. And within that particular organizational form, we have developed this corporate voting in order to make shareholder voice heard. But this is, of course, completely different problem than what we see for nation states.
And is it empirically so, because you do a lot of empirical studies, that the more democracy reigns within a company, the more successful it is? In other words, is there a correlation between the degree of democratic involvement and return on investment in a corporation? Is there a clear empirical state that you would be able to tell us?
No, because it's too complex to answer that with one single question, because there's so many different things shareholders can vote for, but there's also a clear line what shareholders cannot vote for. So shareholders can, for example, submit proposals to be voted on to the annual meeting, but these proposals cannot interfere with the day-to-day work, for example, of the corporation. That is what the CEO or the management team has to do. So yes, there is empirical evidence which shows that with certain decisions shareholder made, that we see positive performance. But there is also evidence, of course, where we have a negative correlation between certain votes.
So there's a fine line to walk, and it's not clear what is beneficial to the company. So from your point of view, why would then companies be determined to increase their own democratic culture if it's not beneficial to the business itself?
Well, that is a little bit the question, right? So is this shareholder voting, is this just a game which we have to play? I mean, a lot of it is coming through regulation, right? So companies have to do this, but then there's a lot of freedom also how they do it. So I think it's a good question. I cannot give you a good answer to it, but I think there's both. I think, of course, if you run your company, you also would like to hear your shareholder base. But there are also maybe things where you would prefer to not hear them, but you have to hear them. And we also have, of course, to, when we think about democracies, especially if we take this analogy to nation states, we think about dispersed set of shareholders. But that has, of course, also changed, right? If we think about the big asset managers, for example, BlackRock, they have like 13 trillion of assets under management, State Street, Vanguard. They are these block holders in this corporation. Of course, they hold the shares for the investors. But if they would call the CEO, I'm sure the CEO would answer the phone, right? So there are different mechanisms at play. Not everything will come and has to come through voting. But I think because what you said in the introduction, that corporations shape our daily life probably as much as our governments these days, it's very important that shareholder voices are heard, and not just the ones from the huge institutional investors, but also from the others investors, because they own the corporation. And therefore, I think it's good if we improve processes within the corporations.
So two takeaways from here by me. The principle one voice, one vote does not hold in corporations, because if you are a big shareholder, your voice has more weight, so to speak, and you're more influential. That's one difference. And the other, maybe you didn't say that, but it's something that I heard, is that it might be good for the image of the company, the public image, to be able to say we have democratic structures installed, because that would be beneficial to the company as a whole, because the image would be positive in a public perception.
Yes, but a lot of it is also mandated through regulation. So there's for example, directors election, companies cannot choose whether they do this or not. They have to do this, right? So we also have to see there is this body of regulatory concepts. It differs for every country, but these are put into place to protect shareholders. They have been put in, there are changes, but of course also usually we are very reactive, right? So things happen, Enron, the banking crisis, .com. And afterwards we look, okay, so what went wrong and how can we fix it? And then a new regulation comes into play. Mm-hmm. Also, not all companies are as easily structured as we say. If we, for example, look at Meta, they have a dual...
That is the Facebook company, so to speak.
Yes. They have a dual share class structure. So the economic rights are discoupled for the voting rights. So Mark Zuckerberg still owns the majority of voting rights, whereas what we call the cash flow rights, or the rights to the dividends and the earnings, are normally distributed to the shareholders. So this is, of course, something which is very undemocratic in the sense from what we usually know from nation states.
I see. So your research project here at the Collegium is on the very process of voting. How does that take place? What are the rules that govern the voting process? And again, it seems it's very different from a usual democratic nation state vote.
Yes. So because I think that corporations play such an important role in our society, I think it is important that shareholders have a voice. And therefore, we have to look how are these voting processes structured.
And in your proposal, you write there's very little research on that, actually.
There are research papers, but it's not as well analyzed as political voting. When we talk about political voting, there's so much research about on which day the voting takes place, what form the ballot should have. In the Netherlands, they're currently testing shorter ballots, right? So there's this whole idea of it matters how the ballots look, how we vote, when we vote, whether it's online, whether it's offline, and all these kind of things. And I think that also, so the theory is there, we just need to apply it to what we see in corporations.
And that would make it an interdisciplinary approach, because you combine behavioral economics, political science, economy itself, and maybe psychology, and you try to work with all of these insights to get a better grip on what happens when voting for or in a company.
Yes, because we know that people are perceptive to nudges, so we are like...
What is a nudge? Could you explain that to the human? You know, not everybody might be...
Yeah, like a little push in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, instead of putting chocolate next to the cashier, putting apples or something healthy there, because we know that's where people take last grab before checking out.
So it's a design of a decision.
It's a design of a decision. There's, of course, there's a, a lot of research, and it also is a bit, is it ethical? When is it not ethical? And when we look at corporate ballots in the US, for example, we see that on top of each decision, there is a recommendation from the board of directors. So the board of directors recommends you to vote for all nominees of the board of directors. Mm-hmm. So that is a typical nudge, because it nudges us to vote for that. Why is that especially relevant for corporate voting? Because we have so many decisions to make. If we are talking again about citizenship, we usually vote in one and two countries. And even then, it's very difficult to become an informed voter, and we would like to have informed voters. If you're invested in 100 companies, and you would need to do 100
you're
times...
You're overwhelmed by this.
You receive this material pre-voting. These are like 50 pages which you have to read. You cannot do this, right? So then you start to do shortcuts in your head.
And you're more susceptible to the nudging itself.
Yes, I would say so. And I think it's nice to take what we know from different disciplines and put this together.
Is it part of your findings that in cooperative voting processes, there's more nudging going on than in other voting processes?
Yes, because it's also not as regulated. But for example, we also have to think about there's a way we order the ballots in political voting, right? In Germany, for example, it's the party who had the most votes the last time. And that can matter as well, right? Because how many people really read the ballot till the very, very end, right? You start at the top and then you go down. Mm-hmm. And there are more of those in U.S. corporate voting, I must say, because I do my research about the U.S.
And the objective of your research, is it more descriptive to show what's going on actually? Or is it normative in a sense, what's going on isn't quite right, we should change it?
Well, I think it is important first to do the descriptives, right? So first we have to see and catalog, okay, this is what is going on, this is what is happening. And then based on that, we can also test, because the voting results in the US are public, or you can buy them with a database. You can test, okay, how does voting differ based on the different kinds of ballots which we see? Right? And this, then we have the descriptives, okay, this is what is going on. Then we can see, okay, is there an effect? Could also be that there's no effect, right? But we test, is there an effect? And then we can come up with policy recommendations.
And these policy recommendations would basically be guided by an idea that is an idea for any election, namely that it's fair and free. And that would be the ideal also for you of a corporate democracy.
No.
Interesting.
Well, I say no, because I think the question is, how does it fit with freedom and how does it fit with the topic of the collegium here? And I think for that, we need to make like a little bit a detour.
Do, please do.
So we started, and I think your intro was very beautiful. We started with that corporations shape our life almost as much as governance these days. And then we have all these pressing problems from our societies, climate change, social inequalities, and all the things we discuss here during this year. And for some reason, we started to look at corporations for the solutions and not at governance. Oh, well, we do look also at our governments, but we also look at corporations. So the question is a little bit, why? Right, so that's the first question. Why do we look at our corporation? And this is where your introduction fits so very well. So we have seen that corporations have become so powerful in our lives. One thing is privatization. So when we look back over the last decades or like half a century, a lot of things which are usually in government hands are private now. Water supply, energy supply, public transport, nursing homes, prisons, daycares, right? So a lot of things that are vital for us are private. Also, with digitalization, all the data, like the big companies, right?
And that's a process that is usually referred to as a neoliberal change, that more and more public services turn private.
Yes, and what we really need in our life, right? And the second thing is that we have, through globalization, these corporations have become very big, or some of them have become very big, very international. Goods can just move from country to country, data or digital goods even faster. Mm-hmm. But regulation usually stops at the border and laws also. I mean, we have treaties and all these kind of things, but culture around different countries is different. When we talk about, for example, data in the EU, data is something which is needs to be protected. When we look at the US, data is also an asset for national security. So we have companies operating worldwide. And then on the other hand, regulation stops at the border usually. So there's a regulatory vacuum.
A gap somehow,
which is very difficult. And we have seen this already in the 90s and the 80s with the sweatshops, right? If we raise prices here, production moves somewhere else. A very easy mechanism. And then with the reach of the company, so they become bigger through technology, they have a much larger reach. They have become so much more powerful. So and also more political. So when Google, that's already a long time ago, decided to censor search results in China, yes, that was a corporate decision, but it was also a political decision. Mm. When Elon Musk provided Starlink or not provided Starlink to the Ukraine, it is a company decision, but it's also a political decision. So they've become so powerful. But if corporations are so powerful and we give and allow them to be so powerful, then it's important that the owners of the corporation, the shareholders, have a voice in it.
I think we are at a fascinating point right now, and it's a fascinating project that you have, because one way, and I try to rephrase it so that I understand it myself, is our topic here at the Collegium is reinterpreting freedom. Now, it could be said that companies enjoy a special kind of freedom. For example, the freedom of the markets or the freedom to move transnationally. And actually, you try to find out what is the responsibility that comes with that freedom and how to work with the responsibilities that companies you right now obviously have. I mean, you mentioned Elon Musk, you mentioned Facebook, you mentioned other companies. One has more and more the impression that companies run the world and not nation states. But where is the responsibility and how are they held accountable?
Yes, and there is, of course, this urge for what we call corporate social responsibility. But my project is really about, okay, what is the say shareholders have in this? And therefore, I'm interested in...
And do you have any trust or maybe any indication that the shareholders with their own objectives in holding that share are more responsible than the CEOs themselves?
Oh, that's a difficult one.
Because, you know, my pedestrian assumption would be if I hold a share, I want the share to gain in price. And if not, I'm disappointed. And I'm not really that interested how that works.
Well, we have seen instances where we had environmental proposals, so proposals which asked the company to improve their environmental footprint, which were accepted by the shareholders. And many of these decisions also carry a financial component. For example, if you do not invest in green technologies now, you could be too late, right? So there's the pressure of future regulation on you. So we could even argue for the long-term value of a firm, it's important to invest in green technology now. I'm confident, right, that there are these cases, but of course, all shareholders are different, right? It's the same with individual actions. Some of you reduce, especially when we talk about the environment, but I don't want to make it just about the environment, social inequality, and there are different things we need to think about. But the environment is probably a good point to start, because some of us do individual actions, some others more, some less, right? So it's a continuum. And I think the same continuum holds also for shareholders. So they are also socially responsible investment funds. So they try to invest responsible. You can vote on shareholder proposals which favor the environment.
But is there any empirical evidence that there is a more value-driven stance from the shareholders when they make their choices? Because one would like to imagine that within the last 20 years, the consumer or the shareholder, for example, has become more conscious of certain implications and certain dangers. And are they more value-driven now in their decision-making than maybe, say, 1980?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. But I would argue that this is a very European point you were just raising. I don't think that across the globe, everyone becomes more conscious about this.
And when we talk about responsibilities, Tanya, we know if I switch to MSNBC or Bloomberg, it might happen that I see a CEO say something like, my only responsibility is to the shareholders. And that's the only thing I'm responsible for. And then there's another term, actually, and that is the stakeholder. And maybe you could explain the difference. And there's also a responsibility to the stakeholders and not only the shareholders when it comes to a corporation.
Yes, so this, my only responsibility is towards the shareholder, from Friedman is very misunderstood in general. So that's not what he meant, and that is not...
Milton Friedman is a famous neoliberal economist, maybe the most famous one in the post-war period. Yes.
But I think that this quote is taken out of context of his original article, and he also said, as long as it is in line with the law and as long as it is long-term value enhancing. But of course, different cultures place different weights on different stakeholders. For example, in Germany...
Stakeholders, not shareholders.
Stakeholders.
Yes.
So, and with stakeholders, we usually think about customers, suppliers, employers. So all people who are relevant for the corporation, which are not shareholders, so which are not the owners.
Just a question to understand. Would, for example, be an animal a possible stakeholder? Because the animal doesn't hold a share, but it might be, you know, its very life form might be determined by some corporate decisions.
Yeah, that's very philosophical. But I think the environment is considered, or the community is considered, as stakeholders, right? So there's then also different degrees of shareholders. So I would think, yes.
Possibly.
To come back to that, in Germany, there's, of course, we have the co-determination. So that is that employees have many rights through union representation on the board of directors. So Germany places emphasis on employees as stakeholders. In other countries, it could be more the society or networks of corporations they form. So in Europe in general, we have a more stakeholder-oriented approach than, for example, in the US or in the UK.
Now we have shifted our conversation from corporate governance to corporate responsibility, which is another area of research that you're active in, and you just published a paper with colleagues of yours where you try to find out how the vibe shift that we are experiencing within the last 7 years or 8 years, say, from the first term of Donald Trump, influenced the image that corporations give themselves when it comes to corporate responsibility, especially when it comes to environment and to DEI, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion, right?
Yes.
And these two things seem to be awfully important the last 20 years before Trump took office. And now it seems empirically they are less important.
Yeah, so what we did in this study is we looked at the regulatory language. So this is something else than what firms actually do. But we did it's a very small study. It's a very interesting. We just looked at... So each year, firms have to file the annual report, and within the annual report, they have to provide information for shareholders. And we looked at the language within those filings, the years before Trump was elected and the years or the year after he was elected.
So statistically, how many times they use that very concept or that very word?
Yes. And what we see is there's not much change when it comes to the language on environment. So corporation take it as serious, and they also would like to present themselves as taking it so serious. But what we see is a huge decline in DEI language. So where they usually, before Trump, used statements that they have programs for diversity, equity, and inclusion, that they have DEI hiring, that they have DEI offices, a lot of this is gone now. This has, of course, to do because Trump also threatened
It's 25% less, which is a massive finding, I think, like a quarter.
Yes, because he said, if you do this, you will not have, you have no chance to get governance contracts, or we can even sue you for it. So firms do this. They just change the language. So what we don't know is whether they also change actions. So this is a black box which we cannot observe.
Mm-hmm.
But what we see is that there seems to be that they adapt to the political situation at hand. So that's not the, now the second question is, of course, and we can be a bit cynical to that, is that good or not?
Yes, but it also lends some plausibility to a suspicion that many humanists like I myself would have towards this talk about corporate responsibility, namely that it's mainly window dressing. And once it's threatened, it's out of the window immediately.
Yeah, and there's all, it's not just... I mean, we can peel back a little bit the onion here, right? So we can ask ourselves the first question, why do corporations do CSR in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And is
CSR
this
would be here?
A corporate social responsibility.
Yes.
So is it marketing? For sure. What we also see, if there are incidents, for example, Black Lives Matter, we suddenly see firms reacting to that as well. And also usually these are firms who are in the public limelight or who are consumer firms. So this component might be there. I also think there are firms who generally care about certain issues within this corporate social responsibility spectrum. But we also see, of course, that it's has a weak foundation, I would say. So with this DEI, the question is now, and I've heard both. So I think some companies are there and say, oh, finally, we can do what we do and we don't need to take care so much of this. But I also heard from corporations, they just change the language, but they just keep on doing what they did before. And that is having a DEI strategy in place, but not laid out.
And again, let me ask you, how is it empirically? Do companies that have a firm DEI policy and are more inclusive and are more polyphonic and more diverse, do they perform better? Is there any evidence that they do? Because the last 20 years, at least that was my impression as an outsider, there was a strong discourse saying it's not only good, it's not only normatively right, it is also good for the performance. And we know that by now. We have empirical evidence for that. Is there such evidence?
So let's focus on gender diversity, for example, because that's a little bit easier because it's just something we can easily observe.
Hmm. Yes.
Where it's a little bit different.
Statistically, it's easier to get a grip on it.
Yeah, and yes. It's also in all databases. It's coded whether you're
yes.
a man or women. Over there have been thousands of studies. And I think if we take all of this together, and if we look at also the better studies, which look at causation and not just correlation, they show that there's no correlation between, for example, how many female board of directors you have. So the quote was, a percentage of women on the board does not influence the financial performance of the firm.
So it's inconclusive.
It's inconclusive, yeah. But I also think we can just say that we haven't seen a good study which shows that there is a positive effect. So there could be for certain firms, right? If we do these huge empirical studies, we look at 1,000 firms. So we look at the average effect. That doesn't mean that for certain firms with certain persons where there's a good match, that this can lead to better financial mm-hmm. performance. But I think usually we're saying, yes, if we have more women on board, then we make better decisions and that leads to better financial performance. I think saying this for all the firms, that's not true. There is no empirical evidence there. And of course, as a feminist myself,
yes,
it hurts. But I think there could be normative, like you said, reasons for pushing for more female representation.
Yeah, and now that you tell me that, you could also say there's a window of moral opportunity opening, because you could say as a corporation, well, it might not make for better decision-making, but we do it because we think it's the right thing to do. So it's not on the performative level, but on the value level that this very finding that there is no such correlation would open a moral opportunity and say, this, we do it because we believe in it. It's not about performance.
Yeah, and of course we have to, corporations are built in a way that the board of directors has a fiduciary duty towards the shareholders. So this is something we could vote on, right? Or which the shareholders mm. already vote on, because they vote on the directors, right? So you could provide them with a female candidate. When it comes to other diversity dimensions, they're much more difficult to measure. And usually, for example, the LGBTQ community is not as much represented, so you can make like big empirical studies, or at least not out of the closet. So that's more difficult. There are also scholars which say, well, what matters is cognitive diversity. So and this is something you cannot...
People who think differently or out of the box sometimes, as I say. Yes.
But of course, then if you look more into the behavioral science, there's also research which show that homogeneous groups make better and faster decision. And that gives, I mean, it's a good curveball to our Collegium group, right? We have a very, very heterogeneous group.
Yes.
And decision making can sometimes be very slow.
Yeah, we will get to that because you mentioned that you used that term, me as a feminist. And I like to hear that, especially because it seems to me, and you might tell me if that's the case, that you're still a professor of finance in a very male-dominated field. When we think of economy and finance, we usually think of a man. And in academia, I don't know what the quota between female and male professors in economical sciences is, but I would believe it's much less than, for example, in French literature or in pedagogy.
I agree. So we have economics is a little bit different than finance, but in finance, we are very male-dominated and very male-dominated field, but it is changing. So that is also very good to see. So especially on the junior faculty level, so the new incoming assistant professors, we have a much more diverse group of people. So I think certain things just need time, and it's very difficult to force this, right? So even if we would want to hire more female full professors, there are not so many, right? So it's very difficult.
It's hard to nurture such a culture.
Yeah, but there's a lot of talented women growing into this role now. And I think what we need to do is to make sure that we can retain them and that we give them the best opportunity or equal opportunities than our male colleagues, especially through building a family and so, because these are, of course, the years when you're assistant professor, associate professor, late 20s, early 30s, where this usually plays a role.
But as a professor, you're, for example, also a PhD advisor. You have many young students coming to you asking for advice and career advice. Is there any advice that you would give, especially to female students or female potential academics, that you wouldn't give to male? In other words, is there a kind of sensitivity that you would like to share with female students? Because some students might be listening to us, and maybe a student here at the HSG St. Gallen, a young woman, might think, I like finance, but I don't like it so male dominated. I don't want to be part of this boys group.
No, follow your heart. I mean, if you like what you do, just do it. And I think we will get there. It's slow. It's maybe slower than many of us would like it to be. But we have all these talented women. And I think in a matter of time, we get to a point where we say, yes, this is how we would like it to have. I also think that equality, for me at least, is about, or equity is about equality of opportunities and not equality of outcomes. Mm-hmm. So there are just fields which are gender skewed, right? If you look at primary schools, there are usually more female teachers, right? And it's also not that we're standing there saying, we need now a quota to have more.
Although there's a lot of discussion, what is the effect to the male population that almost from kindergarten to university, most of the teachers are women?
No, and I do see, or I can see that especially for our boys, it would be very nice to have once in a while a teacher. But still, we are not, there's a discussion, but we're not there and throwing quotas into the room, right? Mm-hmm. And I think maybe a certain skewness is just there and we need to accept that. But I think everybody should have the same opportunities to get there. And if we have talented young male teachers, they should be welcomed in the high schools and the kindergartens to the same extent than women.
Of course. Is there a network of female economists or an organization for female finance professors where you try to create a group and be a bit more powerful and maybe a bit more helpful to the younger students? And you're part of such an organization?
Yes, so we have, so there are various, on various levels. So for students, there are organizations. I also think the MBF, the Master of Banking and Finance, has such a group.
Here at the HSG?
Here at the HSG. Mm-hmm. So we also have, from our student association in Amsterdam, regular meetings for our female students. On the professor level, we have this. This is a little bit more field. It's not just for finance, because then it would be very, very small room.
Yes.
But in general, for female professors and for female economists, there's something. And we see this more and more because there's just people realize that this is important. But again, I also feel we need to be a bit more careful there. So it's good to have this, but we also should be careful to not tell women that they need to do a lot of more extra networking in order to arrive at the same position as the males, right? So I think it's great to have a support network. It's great to have mentoring opportunities. That all helps. But it would be good if it would not be needed in the first place.
I see. You spoke of different cultures and how difficult it is to work with cognitive plurality because it's all too easily a cognitive dissonance and the polyphony turns into a cacophony and no one understands anything. But you yourself are a multicultural child in many ways. Your father is from Latin America. You grew up in Germany. You work now in the Netherlands. That's one part of being a multicultural existence. But you also started out as a mathematician and then turned towards finance and then towards corporate governance. That seems to be a rather unusual trajectory. What happened?
What happens? Good question. Life happened.
Mm-hmm.
And
as it should.
Yes, as it should. And I need to say, and I want to stress it, that I'm exactly where I would like to be. But I was always one of those kids or students who dreaded the questions, and what do you do after graduation? So it starts when you're in high school, everybody knows what they want to do. And then I go, what do you do after graduation? I was like, I don't know. So I decided to study math because it was always good at math. So that was the only reason I did this. I liked it. It's math is beautiful.
And it's a rare talent.
Yeah.
So they say.
Yeah, but it's very... There's usually right and wrong, right? So in a sense, it's very easy, whereas like we discussed now, A might lead to B if C, D, E, F, and G are true, right? So it was very nice. And then after 4 years, I was seeing the end of my studies, and then people started asking again, oh, so you're almost graduating. What are you going to do? What is the next step? And I was like, phew. And then... I was very lucky having a really great master thesis supervisor, and he said, oh, well, think about a PhD. And I said,
that was in Gießen, am I right?
And then
you
Münster.
Went to in Münster, and then you went to Berlin.
Yeah, no. So, and I said, well, four or five other years of studying, that sounds great. I can push back all these questions about what to do with my life a little bit more. And so I started looking around. I applied for math PhD positions, for finance PhD positions, without knowing what finance was in the first place. So I remember I had my interview for the PhD.
For those who don't know, finance is the art of how to spend it. Once you have money and you have the need to spend it, you need finance. Is that correct?
Well, it's more about how we make financial decisions.
Good. But if I don't have any money, there's nothing much to decide, right? Maybe. Okay, but
how to raise money. If you don't have money, you can raise funding, right? So
Okay. But you said you turned towards finance.
And I just, the good old gut feeling told me when I went to the universities of St. Gallen to apply for a PhD position that this is the right thing, even though I didn't know what it is.
So for you, it's a homecoming here at the St. Gallen Collegium.
Yes.
You did your PhD here.
Yes.
And then... you found that it's not the more abstract concepts that you're interested in, but the questions of corporate governance and the more soft skills. I mean, it's rather soft compared to other things.
Well, it's less quantitative. Mm-hmm. But of course, when I applied here, it was a derivative risk management share at that time. And I was just, I think it was a Christmas dinner party or something, I sat next to this professor and he was telling me about decision. It was about the vitamin cartel and we were discussing how cartels or cartelistic behavior happen within firms and what does the CEO know and what doesn't the CEO know. So this was our discussions and then we started working on a project and then I stayed in that area.
So students of the Haske, if you can hear us and you're a first or a second year student and you know exactly what you would like to do and what you would like to become, that might change. And there's a huge openness in your career and in your trajectory and it's good to be that open. And that is also your experience.
Yes. And I think in general, I mean, I have a lot of student contact, of course, in my job. I see two kinds of students. There's one type who knows exactly what they would like to do. And they do the bachelor, and then they do the right master, they do the right 3, 4, 5 internships, and then they're exactly at the position where they would like to be and where they would like to go. And then there are more students like me who just follow the flow and doors opened and you go through them and you don't really know what happened. And that's also okay.
That's also okay. Tanya, our topic here at the Collegium this year is reinterpreting freedom. And many of our fellows think there's a real need to do that because we live in dire times, potentially catastrophic times. Do you share that view?
I think we need to rethink and reinterpret freedom. I also think we really need to change things, but I also feel we need to work with what we have. So do we need changes? Yes, because we see the world which we have and the systems which we have are not beneficial for all equally. Are we living in this really dire time? That would go too far for me. But I think it's important that we ask this question now and that we can find ways to go forward to improve the systems which we have.
So you're always more on the reform than the revolutionary side. Work with what we have, be pragmatic and see what we can make better from where we start.
Yes, I think that sums it up very nicely.
And Tanya, this is an experiment, this Collegium. It's an experiment of different cultures, of different ways of how to gain knowledge, how to write, how to think. How is it for you? Because you are, I think, one of the two economists in this year's Collegium, and you have to deal with a lot of humanists. Is that an enriching and a strange experience? Or do you think, I thought it should be a bit easier and it's not as easy as I imagined?
All of the things you were just saying. So it's enriching because it's a very different perspective. So I learn a lot, and especially also about the way you think, because I think we think a little bit different about things. And with you, I don't mean necessarily
but the fellows.
The fellows, the fellows from the humanities. I also thought it would be easier in a sense of what we would like to achieve, right? Because we have very different ideas of what we would like to discuss. And I think part of this is also because the scientific methods of the fields are very different. Mm-hmm. And maybe also not as well understood by each other what other fields usually demand from each other. So, I mean, for finance or economist, I can say we usually have an hypothesis and then we test this either with a model or with empirical data, and then we come into we reject or accept this hypothesis. So this is the way of thinking I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. And I think, of course, in the humanities, you can be a bit more free in terms of what you do. You're not so much confined by reality in a sense, which is very refreshing, but which also I think leads to frictions or can lead to frictions.
Yes.
Because you sit there and think that sounds great to start from scratch with our world, but how is that actually working out in practice if we want to like do everything new?
I see. And then of course there's also the question, I think it's a question on our mind too, how to measure success when it comes to such a Collegium. You're an expert of how to measure things in social processes. And of course there's one way to say, you know, the number of publications the fellows produce during that year and how many times they are quoted by other scientists, that's one way to measure success. But then to my mind, success would also be if you or I wake up, like say in 4 years, and we remember something that we said during a conversation, said, without Tanya, I wouldn't have had that thought. Or without Arpad, I would never have thought that. And then maybe it leads to a new idea in your own research. I think it's very hard to measure that. For me, it seems almost implausible to say if it was a success or not when you purely access it through a quantitative lane.
No, I agree with that. I agree. And I also think it's how we are shaped by it, right? So we are now a little bit past the midterm line. So we will go home soon. And then the question is, of course, okay, what can we take with us from this? And I think this is also success. But nevertheless, we are also here with having an agenda, right? We would like to reinterpret freedom.
Which we do. We try very hard.
So, from different perspectives.
Yes.
So I think it's also good that we have something tangible at the end.
Which we'll have with our result. It's a secret still, but it will soon be revealed. And then we will see how and what we did. Tanya, I mean, we live in interesting times. And, you know, only last week, for example, Donald Trump signed another order that the entire environmental discourse in the U.S. is about to change. And maybe in a year when you do a similar research, you will find that within these corporate reports, there will be 25% less of environmental words in it, because that could be a plausible effect. But there's another thing, and maybe that would be, to the end, one of the questions I'm really interested in. You spoke about the need to understand how a state works and how we can think about corporations in a more democratic way. Right now, for example, the president of the United States, I think, is taking a different turn. He thinks of a state like it was a corporation. And he thinks one should run the United States like a business company. So it's actually the reverse process.
What I think is, I mean, he's a businessman, or that's how he sees himself. And that's maybe the skill set he has, if we can
and the
call
frame, the mindset. Yes.
And I think, and this is just my own pure view on this, is I think maybe he does not understand the difference really well, and that there is much more at stake and also much more connection with other states, that you cannot just roll with a like with a bulldozer, like you could do in a corporate reorganization.
That is not democratic. I mean, a non-democratic
it
corporation.
It depends on what the owners of the corporation would want, right?
Yes, yes. But I guess what I'm getting at is, it makes total sense to me that corporations could learn when it comes to their own democratic structure from nation states or elections. But it might be also possible that the state governments could learn something from the companies and be more efficient and be more clear and be more sober about their decision making.
But maybe we should not look for too much efficiency when it comes to our nation governments.
Interesting from an economist to hear that.
Well, there's a lot at stake, right?
Yes.
And maybe we need to have a good view on what we would like to do. And I don't want to... So I think what is important is nations and corporations are two completely different things. And I think while we use this term corporate democracy for corporations, it's not a democracy, right? And it's something completely else than
what we shouldn't be fooled by this, yeah, by this concept.
And we also should not, while I agree with you that Trump's style is the one of somebody who's used to be in charge of an organization, I think stop the comparison at that point.
Well, that is a nice impulse when we feel the need to reinterpret freedom in a political and economical way. Two last questions. Those are questions that every fellow is asked at the end of the podcast. When do you feel most free?
When I can think and make my own decisions.
Great. And the most important, the very last, the decisive question. If and when you eat a sausage in St. Gallen, will you eat it with or without mustard?
With
mustard. So there is patriotism, but it's not going as far as eating a sausage with mustard. In the Netherlands, you use mustard with a Würstchen too, right?
I think so, but I think if I have the choice, I would use mayonnaise and ketchup.
So that's the Dutch answer to that very question, Tanya. It was a pleasure having you. Thank you for coming to the podcast.
Thank you.
That was No Mustard, the knowledge podcast by the St. Gallen Collegium.